I'm going to talk about these questions in relation to working with archives, writing about thinkers, editing translations, and in relation to these three people, Henri Lefebvre, Michel Foucault, and Georges de Mézil. Now, with Lefebvre, I've done a lot of edited translations, and I've written a book on Lefebvre's work, but I've done relatively little with Lefebvre's archives, and I'll say why in a moment. With Foucault, I've done a lot with the archives in the process of writing what became a four-volume intellectual history of Foucault's whole career, but until now, I've done relatively little editing work. I'll say a bit more about that again later. And with de Mézil, who I'm working on now for the new project, a soon-to-be-published critical edition of one of his texts, ongoing work with his archives, and the plan that he is the major figure probably in the next book that I'm going to write. So the treatment between these thinkers is a little bit uneven in relation to this question of the archive and the translation song, given what I've done. But it hopefully gives a sense of how working with texts in different forms, whether they're handwritten, typescript, printed, variant editions, translations, how that's really at the heart of almost everything that I do. I wrote my PhD on Nietzsche, Heidegger and Foucault, but I did a lot of work on Henri Lefebvre when I was doing my PhD. And the chapter that I wrote on Lefebvre became far too long, and the thesis as a whole was far too long, and it was the Lefebvre material that got cut from the version of my PhD. But some of my early presentations at conferences were on Lefebvre. I'm going to tell some various stories about things, but the first ever conference presentation I gave in 1997, when I was a really nervous PhD student, and the chair of my panel at the Manchester Political Theory Conference said to me after the panel, "Is your PhD on Lefebvre?" And I said, "No." He said, "Oh, thank God for that, because Lefebvre won't get you anywhere." That isn't true, given how much I've done on Lefebvre, but who the hell says that to a nervous PhD student? So, the second conference when I spoke about, I wasn't actually speaking about Lefebvre, but I got talking to Eleanor Kaufman, who invited me to be part of a new book project that she and Elizabeth Labarthe were doing. And Eleanor and Elizabeth had just edited Lefebvre's writings on cities in 1996, and their editor, who was, when they worked with him, was at Blackwell, who had moved to Athlone, and he wanted them to do another book of Lefebvre's, which was Key Writings, a kind of a reader of Lefebvre's work. And Elizabeth and Eleanor wanted me to come on board as somebody who knew the political theory and philosophy side of Lefebvre. So as a PhD student, I was asked to be part of this edited book with these two experienced editors. So that was one bit of good fortune in that led me down a particular path, part of my career. But the other part of that was that Tristan Palmer, this editor that had moved from Blackwell to Athlone, said, "Who's this new guy that you want to work with? Send me his CV." And when I sent the CV to him, he said, "Who's publishing your PhD?" And I said, "I haven't even submitted it yet." And he said, "Send me a proposal." And that's what led me to get my first book contract. So some of these good fortune moments of chance encounters with people and then them leading to other things has been really important in terms of what I've ended up doing in the work. So Key Writings was the first of these that I worked with Elizabeth and Eleanor. It led me to work on the second of these, which was the Rhythm Analysis book that Gerald Moore and I translated. And that here the division of labour was that we discussed a lot of the terminology first. Gerald did the first pass of the translation, which I then edited. I did most of the notes and wrote the introduction. So there was a kind of division of labour between the two of us for the Rhythm Analysis text. And I wrote a book on Lefebvre for, well, it was Athlone when we signed the contracts. It became Continuum, and it's now Bloomsbury Academics, so it's gone through different publishing imprints over time. And since writing that book on Lefebvre, which is in 2004, I've done relatively little on Lefebvre except when I've been editing Lefebvre. I haven't written many things on Lefebvre other than in relation to the edited texts that I've worked on. And I'll be the first to admit, I'm not a good translator. I can read French pretty well, I can understand what's going on in the text and work with the text, but I don't feel I'm very good at rendering it into natural English. And so I've generally worked with other people on that more translational side of things, but I do think if I'm not a particularly good translator, I think I can edit texts quite well, edit translations quite well. And the two aspects of that that I'd highlight for me in that, one is about terminology. So I've worked with some very good translators who don't particularly know Lefebvre that well. So they've done a good translation of the French text, but there's terminological choices that I think, no, that word should be this it's because that's the standard way of translating Lefebvre, so you get consistency between translations. It's consistent internally to the text, distinctions that Lefebvre maybe draws that need to be marked in the way that we translate the English and so on. And that, I do feel that I can add something into the product of producing these. The other thing that has been important for me in terms of editing translations are the notes. And you can do those in different ways. One of them is that you simply copy the notes over from the original text into the translation, which is what a lot of translators end up doing. The kind of the minimal one is if there is an English equivalent of the text that is being referenced, that you provide a reference to that English text. So if they mention Hegel, for example, you shouldn't provide a reference to a French translation of Hegel, you should provide a reference to an English translation of Hegel for a particular point. The problem is that Lefebvre, along with many French writers of his generation, is not very good with his notes. Lefebvre is particularly kind of wafty with the, as Hegel once said, as Lenin remarks kind of type things that you find in his text, and there's nothing. And these can be quite difficult to find, as you can probably imagine, and particularly when it's his own French rendering of a text that was originally written in another language. So that trying to find these can often be quite difficult. And so, I mean, Lefebvre took me a long time to work. He mixed up the lectures on the history of philosophy and the lectures on the philosophy of history in Hegel. That led me down quite a long kind of, am I going to find this quotation kind of type thing? And these, you know, multiple versions of these. The other one is they provide a reference that's wrong, or they don't provide a reference, or there's something that maybe made sense to somebody who was reading this text in the 50s or 60s or 70s. That now for most people would be completely obscure. So you do the work of trying to fill in those kinds of references. And that takes a lot of work, but I think it's necessary. It's something that I want in any text that's got my name associated with it. It's something that nobody, almost nobody ever says thank you for doing this, or like, I appreciated that you did this. But I do think if you don't do it, people notice. So I think this is one of the things that's quite important in terms of the making of these texts available to people, and there were examples in the talking about Benjamin, talking about Deleuze in the earlier presentations about that. I went on to do the State Space World collection, which is probably my favourite of the Lefebvre books that I've worked on, that Neil Brenner and I did. We had problems with the rights for this. Lefebvre wrote a massive 4-volume, 1600-page book called De l'État, but we couldn't get the rights to the translation of that text, and so we had to work around it. It's lectures, it's conference papers, it's journal articles, it's texts that are close to that, that gives some sense of what Lefebvre was doing in that work, that we compiled into this collection. With all of the notes, Gerald Moore did, the first pass of the translations that Neil and I edited. We filled in a lot of the notes for that. We wrote a long introduction, which is about 25,000-word introduction to that text. And the reason I'm sort of saying that detail is that the research assessment in the UK doesn't like edited books. And I said to my department, this State Space World is one of the best things I have done in the recent research assessment. It's like, no, it's an edited book, they said. And I said, well, it's a rather different type of thing than a 10 people that you know, living people that you know who've written essays on a theme. That's an important type of product, but this is a different type of product to that. It's a collection, it's an edited, semi-critical edition of some of these texts. No, they said it's an edited book, not even with the long introduction. And yet the outtakes from that introduction, which Neil and I published as a journal article, that they were interested in submitting because it was a journal article. And so part of the reason I'm saying this story is that you don't do these things necessarily for career advancement. You don't do these things because it's going to, you know, get you the promotion or the research assessment and so on. But you do them because they can be productive for your own work, but also potentially they can be productive for other people's work, in that they make possible the use and appropriation by others. And I've done a lot of edited books. I certainly see them as important to what I do. But you don't necessarily do it, certainly not in a politics or geography program, for the kind of research assessment type metrics. I've worked with Verso recently. We did the Metaphilosophy book that David Fernbach did, the translator. David Fernbach's a very experienced translator who, among other things, has translated a lot of Marx's writings. David and I discussed some of the terminology in that book. Again, there were an awful lot of references that needed to be filled in, and David was able to do the Marx ones, but the Heidegger ones and the Sartre ones and things like that were ones that I added into that. And again, I wrote an introduction to that text. And then the On the Rural collection, that is the most recent of the ones that I've done as Lefebvre, Adam David Morton and I were the co-editors of that text. Robert Bonanno was commissioned to do the translation of that, and Adam and I edited those translations, filled in the notes, wrote an introduction, and so on. The challenges of doing that one were that we did most of the editing work during the pandemic, and Adam now teaches at the University of Sydney, so we weren't able to get together to actually meet to do some of the editorial work, which was what we had intended to do. But it also meant that libraries were closed for large periods of the time, so actually tracking down some of those references was extremely difficult when I didn't have easy access to the British Library or other places that I would use, or able to get to France to do that. I keep saying with Lefebvre, this is it, I've done my last edited translation of Lefebvre, given how much work there. I've written introductions to a couple of other Lefebvre translations as well, and sort of acted as an advisor sort of behind the scenes on those. But there are a couple of other ideas with Lefebvre that have been mentioned as possibilities. One of them is that Verso continues. They did the Metaphilosophy book, they've done Hegel, Marx, Nietzsche most recently, and the idea of doing Lefebvre's book, La fin de l'histoire, the end of history. And I may not be involved in that, but it's a book that I suggested to them might be one to, if they're continuing the work on the more philosophical side of Lefebvre, that might be the next one to do. And with Minnesota, who did the On the Rural collection, a sort of an idea for a Writings on Space and Politics book, which would basically collect all of the other pieces by Lefebvre on those themes that haven't already been translated in existing collections. So that's the kind of the editing translation side with Lefebvre. Lefebvre's archive is, until very recently, was very restrictive. There was very little that was available to anybody. Norbert Guterman, who Lefebvre worked with in the 1930s in France, and then Guterman, who was Jewish, moved to the US. His archive, Norbert Guterman's archive, is at Columbia University. And that was the first ever archive work I did, about 20 years ago now, where I went through the Guterman papers at Columbia, and certainly at the time they were completely uncatalogued, and so you would have a letter and a manuscript by Lefebvre, and the next thing would be a Dear Uncle Nobby Christmas card, and it was just everything was all jumbled up together. But there wasn't very much there. It was interesting to look at, but it wasn't very much in terms of the material. What has changed though is that Lefebvre's own papers, which until recently were in his family home in the Pyrenees, apparently were kind of crumbling house with, you know, rain getting through the roof and that sort of type thing. They're being moved to this archive, which some of you may recognize, IMEC in Normandy, which is a contemporary French publishing archive. It has some of the Foucault papers, it has Althusser's papers, it has about half of the Derrida papers and so on. And it has a wonderful reading room, which is actually inside the old Abbey building. And I understand that Lefebvre's papers are going to be deposited at IMEC, which I think could be really interesting for the next generation of people working on Lefebvre to have access to material. All of Lefebvre's lecture notes, which we have no published record of, presumably within this collection. I have been asked a couple of times if I might write a biography of Lefebvre. And I'd always said no, because I said, look, I've written a book on Lefebvre and there's no really new material available to change that, and I'd end up writing the same book but with maybe a little bit more detail about the life. This may change with this access to material that has now become available there. With Foucault, so far I've done a lot of work with the archive, which has become available progressively over the last decade or so. There are various bits of it that were available in earlier periods, although relatively little used, but since 2013, Dan mentioned this, since 2013, with the sale of all of the papers that were in Foucault's apartment at the time that he died, for like €3.5 million to the Bibliothèque Nationale, these papers have become progressively available to researchers, and Dan mentioned the Confessions of the Flesh, the fourth volume of the History of Sexuality, is among those papers. And these books, the first one of these I wrote was Foucault's Last Decade, and I've almost, not quite, but almost gone backwards chronologically in terms of the writing of these books. And it's simply because when I was working on Foucault's Last Decade, the material on the 1950s and 1960s that I used for the last of these two books just wasn't available. it wasn't accessible, and that the opening up of the archive has made it possible for me and others to do work that wasn't possible even 10 years ago in terms of those papers. Why this has been important to me, I suppose, if you look at the files of papers on Foucault's desk, the working practices of how he was operating, these are the very files that you can now access on your own desk in the Bibliothèque Nationale. It's at the Richelieu site, the central Paris, the older library, not the modern Mitton site. And just to give a couple of examples of this, so this is Foucault's reading notes on Immanuel Kant's essay on the different human races. By Foucault's standards, a relatively neat page of notes that he keeps these large, thematically organized but completely undated files of notes on various topics. And it's clear that he moves stuff around. These are his working files, after all. He moves stuff around when his projects change and transform. And that you might find notes that were taken in the 1950s next to notes that were taken in the 1970s or the 1980s, because you can tell sometimes with the style of writing or various other clues, but almost nothing dated that would allow you to be more precise around these questions. This is a page of a Foucault lecture on the painter Edouard Manet. And this one was a helpful one when I was beginning work on this, because it's one that has been published both as a photo image of Foucault's own page, but also alongside it a transcription. And that helps to kind of learn the handwriting and start to, if you practice enough with the ones that are transcribed in that way, then you can start to read things that are not transcribed in that same way. One of the things that caused me quite a lot of trouble at the beginning with working on Foucault is that he abbreviates quite a lot of French words by Greek letters. And some of those are relatively easy to straight, delta is Dieu, God. But one that took me a very long time to work out, it looked like a misshapen capital H. And it took me a long time to realize it was actually a mu, an M. And it stood for, in various contexts, metaphysics or monde, world. So things like that that took quite a while to actually work out what Foucault was doing with some of these terms and sigma for science and so on. So the materiality of the text, though, was also something that I was very interested in seeing. Foucault does discard a lot of material, often the penultimate version of a book. Once it had gone to the publisher and it had been typeset, then that penultimate version no longer existed. But some of the earlier versions of book manuscripts do still exist. And some of those are very interesting in terms of seeing how Foucault worked, how he went through successive versions of this. And with the History of Sexuality volumes 2 and 3, where Foucault was in hospital when those books were published, and Foucault basically didn't live to destroy the last versions of those texts, there are quite a lot of materials where it's successive drafts of each of the chapters that make up those volumes. And seeing that progress of how he was reshaping material, even the reorganization of material, at one point volumes 2 and 3 was a single large volume. And he split it into two, but not simply cutting it at page 300 or something. It was a slight reorganization of material. And there were things like, you know, this was, I think, common in the 1980s, 70s, when people were writing, of they would write something, they would get somebody to type it for them, then they would take that typescript and write on that typescript and maybe go back to a typist. Or what Foucault often did would cut a passage from it, paste it onto a new sheet of paper, paste another slip from a typewritten version and write the linking part that would then go back to a typist to work on. And seeing that physicality, materiality of the text for me was really interesting in getting a sense in how he had worked. The other thing that I found interesting was things like kind of variant texts, variant versions of texts that were possibly quite familiar. One of those, for example, would be The Order of Things in its English translation has a preface that was written for that English translation. And in Die Écrit, the collected edition of Foucault's short writings, the version of that text in that collection is a translation of the English back into French. And in the archive, they have actually Foucault's own handwritten version of this. And it's very different from the translation back into French. And I can see how Alan Sheridan got from Foucault's version to his English, and I can see how the translator of the English into French got from that English to the French, but the original French and the second degree translation of the French are quite different. And on some terms, this is actually quite important. On so Foucault's distinction between connaissance and savoir, for example, where they both be translated as knowledge in the English, and then the French translator of that English had to guess which term Foucault had in mind, but got it wrong. And so that, I think, has changed some of the ways that we might read that text. The other one that I remember spending quite a lot of time on was what is an author? Kind of ironic, given the topic of this one. People that know that essay by Foucault may know that there are two versions of that. There was a version that was given in Paris, and there was a version that was given at SUNY Buffalo. And both of those supposedly had been published. But the SUNY Buffalo one was published in English, even though Foucault gave the lecture in French to the French department at SUNY Buffalo. And on working with it, I realized that what was claiming to be the SUNY Buffalo version wasn't actually the SUNY Buffalo version. It was a version of the French that had been cut and with a little bit of new material added towards the end to make it closer to what Foucault had given in Buffalo. And part of the reason I realized this was that if you see what Foucault's lecture notes look like and you see a transcript of what he actually said, there's so much interpretation going on in terms of what he had delivered and extemporized and so on, that I couldn't believe that several months apart Foucault could have taken even the same set of lecture notes and delivered a text that was that close to the version that he'd given a few months before. So I worked this all through in kind of fairly kind of careful detail and wrote up something about this. A friend of a friend said, send this to Foucault's nephew, who's now editing a lot of Foucault's texts. He'll be very interested in what you've discovered. And he wrote back and he said, yes, you've discovered what I discovered because I've found the Buffalo transcript. And Foucault does indeed give a very different lecture on the same theme with many of the same topics, but it's quite different from the version that it claimed to be. And it was, for me, it was working through these with the text and actually doing the comparison that allowed me access to some of those kind of questions. With Foucault so far, I've done relatively little by way of translation or edited translation. In the Space, Knowledge and Power book that Jeremy Crampton and I did quite some time ago now, I translated a short text by Foucault. Some of you may know Foucault's Questions on Geography interview, where the geographers of the Erudot journal interviewed him in the very first issue. What's much less known is that Foucault sent some questions back to geographers about what their work was in issue 3 of that journal. So I translated that short text, and then we got some translations of some of the responses to Foucault's questions back to geographers. And there were a few other translations that we included in that work. The most recent of these is the special issue of Theory, Culture and Society that Daniele Lorenzini and Arazzo Herrera and I edited, which includes a number of texts in translation. There's a couple of Foucault texts in there. There's a Pierre Macheret piece on Foucault and Hegel that's translated in there. Melissa Pavelski, who's sitting here, translated a piece by Rainer Nicolaisen, a German historian, about Foucault's year in Hamburg that we got translated for this issue. So when I've done collections, I've always tried to use them as an opportunity to get texts into translation that might be interesting, might be useful. But so far I've done relatively little in terms of editing Foucault translations themselves, but I'll come back to that right at the end. In working on Foucault, though, I've ended up going to the archives of quite a number of other thinkers, Foucault's teachers, Foucault's mentors, Foucault's colleagues, and so on, among whom Jean Hippolyte, Georges de Mazille, Georges Canguilhem, and several others, Louis Althusser, and others. And that work opened up the possibility of me working on Canguilhem himself, and I wrote a book on Canguilhem because it developed out of that interest in discovering the extent of the material in his archive, and that maybe something could be done around that question. It's also led me to my new project on Indo-European thought in 20th century France, of which the two main figures I'm going to look at are Émile Benveniste and Georges de Mazille. And de Mazille is a problematic but I think very interesting figure who was a really significant mentor figure to Foucault from the 1950s right up until Foucault's death in 84, who helped Foucault to get that job in Uppsala that was one of the key things at the beginning of Foucault's career, and was a kind of a mentor and supporter of his career at a number of stages. That room would drive me crazy, the kind of disorder of the desk and the library and the bookshelves and so on. But unfortunately, that's carried across into what de Mazille's own papers look like. A couple of pages there from a lecture that he's preparing. His lecture notes would often begin with text on the right-hand column, and then additions would go into the left-hand column. And a page like that is difficult, but when you've seen actually the published version of the text, I can make some sense of what it is. The problem is when you find things that look like this, and I just struggle to make any particular sense out of something like this. There's a lot in the Drumazeel archive which is absolutely fascinating and I'm finding very useful, but pages like this are extremely difficult, for me at least, to decipher. The handwriting, this is an A4 size, it's very, very small handwriting. But he also, this is before post-it notes, or at least before he had post-it notes, and he would paste these slips onto the side of lecture pages and things. And some of these pages are like kind of folding out a map or a table from an old-fashioned book. But they're often, the scrap paper that he uses is quite interesting, so sometimes it's letters, or it's quite a lot of invoices from his wine merchants that he uses as scrap paper to enhance these lectures. But I find it difficult to believe that he could have used this in a lecture and actually read off this page to think about topics. So I'm working with Drumazeel, and the book I've worked on the most with him is the book Mitra Varuna, which is a book that Drumazeel first writes in 1940 and then goes into a second edition in 1948. And it's a book on the first function of Drumazeel has this famous argument that a lot of pantheons of gods, social organization, the caste system in India is divided along three functions: the sovereign function, the warrior function, and the producer function, effectively. What this book does is to take the first function of sovereignty and to say that this too is split. It needs to be understood in at least two ways. Mitra and Varuna are the two gods that give some sense of this, in the same way that in the Roman canon it would be the Asphidius and Jupiter as the two kind of gods. So one god is the legalistic, contractual, administrative sense of power, political power or sovereignty, and the other one is the kind of magical, terrible, terrifying sense of power. And what Drumazeel does in this book, by taking a number of different examples from Norse myths or from Roman history, which he suggests is disguised mythology, if you read the early books of Livy or something, he says this isn't really history, but it's kind of mythology that is narrated as history. So it's an interesting book. It's a book that Foucault uses. It's a book that I found very interesting. And the English translation, which was done in 1988, is long out of print and often very expensive to find secondhand. So I contacted Zone Books, who did that translation, and said, would you be interested in a new edition of this? And they said, well, we think it's an important book, but we have limited resources, and no, we're not willing to do this. But Howl Books, who are an anthropology press, who had done a book by Emil Benveniste recently, The Vocabulary of Indo-European Concepts and Society, and a new translation of Marcel Mauss's The Gift, for example, Howl Books were very interested in this idea. So I've worked with them on a new edition of this text, which should be out very soon. There's a legal reason why it's slightly held up in the moment in production. What I've done in this is largely to use the translation that Derek Coltman did in the 1988 edition, but I've done an apparatus, so it's a translation of the second edition, the 1948 version, but it's got all of the 1940 variants in notes or in a couple of appendices. And the biggest single task in this was going back and doing the notes. Derek Coltman had just carried the notes over from the French into the English with abbreviations and with a lot of errors. And I thought, can this be done? Can this be done properly? I don't know whether I really realized what I'd taken on when I took this on as a project. Drumazeel was extraordinarily gifted with languages, and the secondary literature is just about every Western European language. Obviously French, but an English and German and Italian, but also Dutch and Norwegian and Swedish and so on. So checking that these were actually where he said that they were was quite a lot of work there. The primary text that he's referencing, Latin, Greek, Norse, Welsh, Sanskrit. Sanskrit was the big challenge in this, because what I was trying to do was not to say this is the very edition that he used, or to provide a contemporary edition that there was a full reference to this, but more to say anybody who's got access to any good edition of this text should be able to find this reference. And a lot of these references are quite precise, but they're not very accurate. You give a very precise indication that it's in Book 2, Chapter 5, but it's actually in Book 5, Chapter 2, or things of that nature. With the Sanskrit, many of these are available in editions that I could access, but there were a couple where I had to ask for specialist help on this because there wasn't, as far as I could tell, any Western European language translation of this text. And some of these were indeed errors that we were able to fix with this. So I think that all of the notes in this new edition are actually accurate now, which is not the case in the existing English translation. But also that I hope the apparatus is useful, and the introduction that I've written, which is a sort of, how did Dumézil get to write this book in 1940? Where did he go between 40 and 48, the two editions? And that is the moment I talk about some of the political controversies about Dumézil's work, and then kind of what the legacy of this book has been. But Veena Das has also written an afterword to this, which picks up on some of the ways his work has been used in anthropology. If I do another Dumézil book, I would quite like to do another Dumézil book. I think it would be this one, would probably be my first choice to do. It's part of the reason is it was published in 1956 initially as a title that would translate as Aspects of the Warrior Function within the Indo-Europeans. It becomes the Early Malheur du Guerrier in 1969, and then just before Dumézil's death there's a third edition of this text, and each of these has additional material in them. So he both goes back and reworks some of the claims in the earlier versions, but adds substantial parts, so kind of about a third additional material in each of the second and third edition. The English translation is of the second French edition, so there's material that isn't translated that I think could be quite interesting. And Chicago, who did that publication, Chicago both distribute HAL books, but also Chicago's a press I've worked with before. So that would be my, if I did another Dumézil book, although there's a kind of, gosh, it's such a lot of work kind of type thing with it. But the other reason why I haven't taken on or proposed this, or even really done the careful comparison of the editions, is because of this project. Many people know that there are two editions of Foucault's Birth of the Clinic, Naissance de la Clinique in the French. There's the 1963 edition and there's the 1972 edition. And these texts are quite different. Foucault goes through the 63 edition in 1972 and removes a lot of the explicitly structuralist vocabulary that's in that text. And so you have these two editions, and this has long been known that there are two editions of this text. So James Bernauer, for example, in Michel Foucault's Force of Flight, provides some examples of the differences between the editions and the importance of some of these terms. But what became important to me particularly is that the English translation is neither of the first edition nor of the second edition, but is some peculiar hybrid of the two. And this is where I think it gets interesting potentially as a story about this. So one of the things I've done is go through, this is a cheaper reprint edition of the second French edition, and to go through and to do a line by line, word by word comparison between the first and the second edition, because even though François Delaporte does some of this work for the Pléiade Œuvre edition of Foucault's work, he doesn't do all of it. He doesn't do it carefully to the degree that I wanted it to be done carefully. I'm just going to give a couple of examples of what Sheridan does in the English translation that show, I think, the problems of the existing translation, which for 50-odd years has stood as the only English translation of this text. So I'm just going to read the English of these, but the French is there on it. So the first edition in the French says, "Is it not possible to make a structural analysis of the signified?" 1963. 1972, Foucault says, "Is it not possible to make an analysis of discourses?" Well, it's quite a different claim in terms of what Foucault is doing in vocabulary and language. What does Sheridan do in the 1973 English edition? "Is it not possible to make a structural analysis of discourses?" It's not just that it's not a sentence that Foucault wrote, it's not a sentence Foucault could have written. It's blurring two distinct periods of Foucault's conceptual vocabulary into that English edition. Just going to give one other example of this. Here as elsewhere, he's comparing this to his other books. "Here as elsewhere, it is a structural study that attempts to decipher in the depth of the historical the conditions of history itself. Here as elsewhere, it is a study that attempts to decipher in the depth of discourse the conditions of its history." It's 1963 to 1972. Quite a shift again in the sort of conceptual vocabulary apparatus that Foucault is using. the English. It is a structural study that sets out to disentangle the conditions of its history from the density of discourse, as do others of my works. And the only way I can really make sense of what Sheridan did, given that the French second edition is 1972 and the first English translation is 73, I think, this is my educated guess rather than knowing, I think Sheridan translated the first edition, but while it was in production, possibly even as late as that, he was made aware of a new French edition, tried to amend it to match the second edition, but didn't do it carefully enough. And you find a lot of the big changes where Foucault removes like whole pages of text and puts in new, but those are largely caught in Sheridan's translation. But sometimes when he's blurring and merging two editions of the text, I think he's making a nonsense of what Foucault is trying to do. But there's also a set of questions about how Sheridan translated rather than just what he translated. Sheridan was really important in the Anglophone reception of Foucault's work. He translated a lot of Foucault's books. He wrote the first English language book on Foucault, but a lot of the choices that he made, I think, have been superseded by how scholarship on Foucault has developed and the availability of material by Foucault that simply wasn't available to Sheridan at the time he was translating. There's a lot of medical terminology, as you'd imagine, the birth of the clinic, that he gets wrong, at least by medical standards, about how you would translate particular terms and so on. There's some questions of style in the text, there's questions of philosophical vocabulary, and so on. So Stephanos Gerulanos, who's done a lot of work on Congreve's work, particularly Congreve's writings on medicine and biology, Steph and I proposed to Routledge that we do a new edition of Birth of the Clinic in English. And we haven't yet signed the contract, but this has gone through the review process and the rights have been secured from the French press. So this is the next big editing project that I'm going to take on with Steph. We're going to employ a translator to do the first pass of a translation of the second edition, and then we're going to fill in all of the apparatus so that all of the variants that are in the first edition are in an apparatus to that text. We're going to provide some supplementary texts, a couple by Foucault on medicine from this period that haven't been translated, a couple of the contemporary reviews of this book's of Foucault's book, both in English and in French, will be included in this. We'll write a long introduction. But we're also going to check all of Foucault's notes, which is not going to be a small task, given the types of medical texts from 18th, 19th century particularly that he's using there. But Foucault makes so many mistakes in the references of his that I have checked that I think it's going to be worthwhile to do that kind of work. I've probably talked too long. Quick set of comments or conclusions, I suppose. I used to say that editing a translation was the best way that I knew to get to know a text. You really do start to understand how an author puts something together if you work on editing it. But I think actually working in an archive can also do that. At its best, it's like taking the back off a clock. A text that you know really well, and then you start to look at how it was actually built and made and constructed and how it works, how the bits fit together, which has been endlessly fascinating for me in terms of working with the archives. I talked a bit about kind of chance and good fortune that I had particularly at the beginning of my career, but one of the things that's been important to me is building relations with publishers and with editors that work with publishers. So Verso and Minnesota have been very supportive of Lefebvre translations over many years, and getting to know the editors and suggesting things to them and working with them has been important. I've done a bit of advising for Polity on some translations, but I've yet to work on a translation with Polity. Routledge we went to for the Birth of the Clinic because they sell the existing version of the translation. So that question of how hard it is to get something translated, but how much harder it is to get something retranslated. If there's already a version that's available and a publisher can sell it, how much harder it is to retranslate it. And the Benjamin is a good example of where that has happened recently, both with the Trauerspiel book and the Critique of Violence. Sarah Richmond did with the Sartre's Being and Nothingness. De Beauvoir's been retranslated. Lévi-Strauss's Le Pensée Sauvage is now not The Savage Mind, that earlier problematic translation, but is now Wild Thought. So there are examples, we could multiply some of those, but it's quite difficult to get a text that's already selling to get it retranslated. But building relations with publishers can be, I think, quite important for that kind of work. And so that's one of the things that's been important to me, is to try and connect to publishers that can enable these things, and the rights holders, and how much time negotiating access to archives, but also for translations, how much you might have to go through a family, a widow, a child, somebody in terms of access to text and the intellectual property rights and so on. Hopefully with Foucault, Birth of the Clinic will be the first of hopefully a series of translations of the earlier books, the books that Foucault himself published, that I think many of which are in need of a fresh translation. Melissa Pavelski did a PhD at Warwick with Oliver Davis and me as supervisors, and Melissa's examination in that is of how Foucault's Severe Punir was translated into the English Discipline of Punish and the German translation. It's a three language comparison of the process of translation. It's going to be published as a book with Legenda. So Severe Punir for me would probably be at the top of the pile for the books by Foucault that should be retranslated, a fresh translation of that text. But for a while at least, I'm going to be spending a lot more time in places like these, various archives in and around Paris. Thank you.